Ariel's Museum. Today is Today is January 23rd, 1992, and we're here to interview Mr. Fred Green about real memories.
Glenn.
I beg your pardon, Glenn.
Good morning.
Why do I think of you as
Fred? Isn't it the 22nd?
I thought it was the 23rd.
It's probably because I remind you of J. Fred Muggs from the old
Show. From the Today Show, huh?
Yeah.
He was a vicious little...
Yeah, they play.
I guess we could just start with some of the stuff, maybe it'll get us rolling.
Sure.
Although you never seem to have doing that. Were you born in Lansing?
Yes, I was.
And I remember at the lunch that we went to a few weeks ago that you said you went up to the ninth grade.
Ninth grade.
Mm-hmm.
At Oakhurst. That was my ninth grade year at the Oakhurst.
Oh.
We were only out there 1 year.
Were you farming out there?
We had 32 acres. My dad bought that, thinking it would keep us guys busy. And out there they had school buses, which other places didn't have. And he liked the location and everything, so he bought the place. And then after 1 year, his aunt offered him 120 acres west of Grand Ledge in South Bend. He had two houses on it. If he would pay the taxes each year and take care of his father and mother, which was her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the straw that broke the camel's back, having us change schools. I think we changed schools. Yeah, we went into Lansing in 29, up to Okemos in 31, and up to Grand Ledge in 32, and we said, we're not changing schools anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was the extent of it.
Mm-hmm.
I've often wished that I had gone on further, because a few years later, I had a chance for a football scholarship out to Michigan State.
I don't know if it's doing anything.
Why don't we stop a moment and you see if you can play it back. Rewind it and play it back and we'll know how yours is coming along. I have a little handheld like that, and if I don't have it right up in front almost for the first, that's why I rely on that one.
Oh yeah, it's all right.
You're doing fine.
Yeah, let me just run it. It's so quiet that I didn't even know it was working.
Yeah,
wonderful. You probably got better when I know it.
Well,
make sure I'm not missing anything.
Yeah, absolutely, sure. That's what it's for. But after moving out there, then I worked around at various little jobs, nothing major, and got a chance to apply at Rio in 37. So I hired in there in the receiving department. And I worked there until after the strike of 37. And they started cutting back on manpower and went to powered vehicles for trucking and stuff throughout the plant. So then I got laid off there then, and they weren't taking anybody back because that's about the time, you see, that they quit making cars. In 37, I was telling Shirley, in 37 they made models, show models for the New York show.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. It didn't go over big, so they just dropped the whole thing, and they had a real nice car, but it wasn't for the public. I mean, they knew they just didn't go for it. And I like what it said out there. They were built to last. And something like 7 years for the first owner to hold onto his car.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, there's no turnover. You don't just don't want to saturate your market, and you're all done. And I think that was one of the things, but they started out trying to make a good product, and we always thought we had a real good product.
Mm-hmm.
But then I came back in 41 to work for the summer. My dad wanted me to take a job at Rio. So I went in there and got into machine repair, and I was there just a month, and they asked me if I wanted to move over to the tool room, and I liked the sound of that better, so I went into the tool room. Then in January 42, I went into the Air Force and came back in 46. Went back to work and worked my way up through the tooling division and ended up the supervisor of tooling for the whole plant. held various jobs on the way through, including back into machine repair as foreman there for about 2 years or so. So I got a chance to get all over the plant and kind of see things, and then past history from my dad and my grandfather's working there, and I've always felt a kinship, and like we were talking about that luncheon,
right,
a family feeling.
Right.
People that maybe you didn't really like in the work area, but outside you see them and they're old friends. And that's, I think that's the key to the whole thing all the way through. And it's terrible that Capper put a few bankruptcies. That's the terrible part. We had people commit suicide because they couldn't get jobs.
In the 70s when it started to go down.
That was after 74. Actually, went into bankruptcy.
74.
Yeah.
You went into bankruptcy in 74?
Yep. I retired August 1st, 74, because they were after my money, because I was trying to keep the place going.
Oh.
I would drive all over town and pick up parts from heat treating or something like that to keep the line going. And this friend of mine, he was engine plant superintendent at the time, and he went with me. We'd pick up that stuff to keep the engine assembly line going. And they were trying to do everything under the sun to put it into bankruptcy, so we couldn't run. And then they fired this friend of mine, and I knew my name was on their list, so I took vacation and called in and said, I'm retired. But I kept my retirement papers signed for 3 months ahead. So anytime I wanted to, I could just say, put it into effect.
Were you able to get any retirement benefits?
Well,
understand some workers got
nothing. Well, yeah, we got our pension benefits, but what they did when this was after the government took it over. See, that they passed that law in sometime just prior to this year or so. Prior.
Chapter 11.
No, the pension benefit guarantee.
Oh, for the pensions, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so. But when they took it over, when the government took it over, they came out with a ruling that they were going back 5 years and pay us off at the pension rate from 5 years previous, because the law said in their interpretation that they could not pay any pension program that had been in effect less than 5 years. So in that 5 years, they canceled our life insurance policies that we had. And we have to pay our own Blue Cross Blue Shield. That takes all of one pension, all of my hourly rated pension, and so a little bit of my contributory pension. So we're getting very little out of that pension, but if it'll pay for the Blue Cross Blue Shield, fine. I can survive on that.
Did the company, doesn't sound like it, but did the company do anything to help these people who were going to be out of work, or were they slowly laying people off, and they didn't do anything to help them get new jobs or
They didn't have any concern about the employees. All they wanted was to get the place into bankruptcy so they could collect money, because they made money out of that with their financing corporation and stuff like that. Trucks that had been sold and financed through them, they could care less about the factory.
Compared to the previous types of management.
Oh, the previous types of management. We had some good ones. Under White, the only thing was that I guess real employees always wanted to be an independent company.
That's right.
But I was there when Bone Aluminum and Brass took it over, and was there when White took it over, was there when they merged us with Diamond T.
I don't
really have a place for that, because I wasn't too involved in any changeover, because they talked about we merged with Diamond T, but Diamond T came up here because we had much better facility than they had. So everything was just merged in piecemeal, and they started building Diamond T trucks, and then it went to Diamond Rail. They just changed the name over. And the thing is kind of a shadowy feeling. I suppose it's someplace in the archives that tells when it happened. But it was a friendly type of merging. Diamond T people come up and work in our plant. Some of the engineers, some people that were in management positions. so that it was easy to merge it in and go ahead and work. But they always kind of rankle the old timers that we were not a private company anymore. And in fact, when we heard that Capric bought the place, knowing that he was an Alma native, we thought, oh, this is going to be heaven, you know, this guy coming in here. But their program from the beginning, as far as I am concerned, they went in and wiped out the accounts payable, put in all new people that would do what they were told, wiped out old-timers in the purchasing department, put in new people to do what they were told. So they had the financial end of it tied up.
They simply gave them a quick slip of those folks.
They were out completely. In fact, this engine plant superintendent, they called him up to the front office at 3:30 on a Friday afternoon, said, "You're fired. We want you out of the plant before 4 o'clock. You go back and take your personal stuff out of your desk and don't come back on the property." So his wife called me that night and wanted to know if I'd come over and talk to him. And he was really despondent. And I told him, I said, "Go back and check with the union, because we have union rights." That was something they didn't take, but they wanted to take it away. And the union wanted to do that because, you know, they don't want supervisors having any preference of going back to work and stuff. But I talked to a few of them and they agreed that they would let them accumulate seniority equal to the amount they had before they went on supervision. So I would have had, I don't know, probably 18 or 20 years, and Ernie had about that same amount. And so he went back to union and they said, "You bet he's going back to work." So he worked until they closed up. But then he went to the Olds and got a job, and he's retired from there with his 10 years. But it was always a troublesome feeling when these other companies wanted to keep real. Now, as far as I'm concerned, and I've got to believe what I was told, that Bowen Aluminum and Brass milked the company. Now, they took stuff out of the company. And so when White took it over, I suppose to them it was a bargain because the thing was down. And we weren't really sure if it was going to keep going or not. But White did. They put a lot of their production down to us. We built trucks for them at different outfits. And so it went along real good under White. Well, then Capric, it apparently got them to sign some kind of a sales agreement. And pretty soon he called them on it and said, "I want to buy that reel." And they said, "No, we know what your situation is, what your program is, and we're not going to sell it to you." So he took them into court, and they backed up and sold it to him. So it was a forced sale, really. I think White would have kept it, and I think had they done it, we would both be in good shape now. But it didn't come out that way.
You mentioned Bowen Aluminum and Brass. Is that Bowen, B-O-W?
B-O-H-N.
B-O-H-N.
Oh, yeah. Out of Detroit.
Bowen Aluminum and Brass out of Detroit.
But I can remember so many things that my dad would tell me, you know, they didn't have any significance then at the time he told me, but different things that went on in the plant, like when the strike, well, of course, I saw a little bit of this when the strike in 37 was over and they went back to work and everybody was on piecework. They only got paid for the number of good pieces they produced. People in the paint ovens, I mentioned that to you, paint lines where they ran them through dips and painted parts. Some of those guys had 6-8 weeks worth of work stashed around in the plant, all ready to go, but they hadn't turned them in, and the company just said, "Hey, these are ours. They should have been turned in, and they weren't, so they're ours. Mm-hmm. You don't own any." Some of the boys were real unhappy. They said, "We're not gonna put out anything anymore," but they came around, and everybody was got back to work.
What did your dad do in the plant?
Well, my dad, he started in along the assembly line, the truck assembly line, And during World War One, they wanted him to become a foreman in tank track manufacturing of the tracks.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, so he went in there and ran that until the end of the war. And then he moved up into, like parts and service. And then he went into tool routing and processing. And so he was in tool processing when he retired.
You said he started in 1904?
I'm not sure if it was four, okay. Five, or six, somewhere.
Just
he
had years.
He had a total of a little better than 50 years in there when he retired in 55. So how that figured out, I don't know. But see, when he started working there, he was only working part-time. Mm-hmm. Because they were driving trucks. He and his brothers were driving trucks from Lansing plant to Chicago, overland. They didn't have any hauls then.
Mm-hmm. Oh, to deliver them for customers?
Right, deliver them to dealers, yeah.
But,
yeah, see, Rail started in working winters because they could hire farmers that couldn't work out on the fields and stuff. And then in the spring, when it came time for planting, they'd shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe build up a supply of parts to work the next winter. Then pretty soon the demand got up to where they started working the year round.
But your father drove vehicles from the factory to where they were going to be sold to the dealers?
They were dealer orders. They were dealer orders. Yes, there were dealers set up.
Uh-huh.
And because he told me about one time they were going down in somewhere down around Berrien Springs or down that area.
Yeah.
And they got on the wrong road, and they ended up in a farmer's barnyard. They had to turn around and drive back out the road and go on down. So it was not very.
I was just going to say, it was probably an adventure to do that kind of traveling.
And
the roads weren't good at all.
No, the roads. And those outfits weren't there roadworthy, you know, to just take off on your own. But I guess you'd done enough mechanic work around so that. Anything that broke down on the way, if it was possible to fix it, fixed it.
Imagine if you had some breakdowns, because cars would do that.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They used to sell a toolkit or something when you bought a car. And I understand
spark plug wrench and stuff like that, always had them.
And the parts in the early days, if you got a part that wasn't exactly standard, you might have to mill off some rough edges or something to make it fit your vehicle. Like today, you can run down the store and buy a
standard
that'll fit.
Well, you can go down now and buy factory authorized parts or replacement parts that are supposedly as good as factory authorized. Mm-hmm. Now everybody can manufacture these parts. They don't have to sell them under that name, but they will fit this model of car. Mm-hmm. Then they didn't have that. It's like the spark plug wrench and a monkey wrench. That was an L-shaped wrench with an adjustable lower jaw.
Mm.
And you can make it fit most any nut. They used to have fun with some kid would come in off the farm and start working around there in the mechanic area. They'd send him for a left-handed monkey wrench.
Oh.
Nobody had him. Nobody had him. He'd come back and he said, well, okay, use this one, but put it in your left hand.
Oh. Was your father a farm boy before he started working there?
His folks had two or three different farms.
In the area?
Well, out around south and west of Grand Ledge, mostly.
Grand Ledge.
Mm-hmm.
What was your father's first name?
Howard
Green.
Howard L. That's where I got my middle name.
What does it stand for?
No, I mean Howard.
Ben Howard. You're Ben Howard.
No, he was Howard Lester.
Oh, okay.
But,
Did he have... in those early days, he must have seen Orioles or Richard Scott or some of those things.
No. He didn't know Richard Scott. He knew Dick Scott.
That's right. He was known as Dick Scott.
Yep.
I said,
how would you know him? He said, he come down and talk to me about a job that we're having trouble with.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really disappointed when Dick Scott was let out.
Oh, he was let out?
Yeah. Yeah, well,
plant
politics. You know, I mean.
But he was general manager, was he? Or?
Yeah.
Through the 20s mostly.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, my dad knew him and anybody that was up in the upper echelon in management had to at some time come in contact with my dad, because he was like I was as far as being all over the plant. And now there again, he had a fourth grade education.
Oh. But he was obviously very mechanically inclined.
He was, and when he got up in processing, he always had to estimate the costs of jobs and stuff. And he'd have a column of figures like this, and like this. And people say, how do you know that's right? He said, check it. They put it on a machine and check it. And one day, they took columns of figures, gave one to this person in the adding machine, and the other one to my dad, and he was done way ahead. Oh. And he was right. Yeah. Those things, you know, I suppose it's a natural talent that somebody is born with that, but it's...
But he owned it.
Yep, they couldn't take it away from him. Al Zimmer was a plant manager, and he was going to cut costs. So he laid off all the people out of processing. We don't need that kind of stuff. It's just paperwork, it's wasted. My dad was pretty well broken because he said, I never figured that Rio could run without me. And I said, well, now that you know it, I hope you're going to retire when you're 65. And he says, not if I can help it. And I said, if you don't, I'm going to break your leg so you won't be in the next day. Okay. And he says, well, maybe. So then after he was laid off for, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks, something like that, they called him, wanted him to come back to work in a different job. He said, absolutely not. I don't have to work, and if you want me, put me back on my regular job or I don't come back. 3 or 4 days later, they called him, put him back on his regular job. And then they ended up bringing back the other guys, too, because they found out that they had to have that to make, because they planned every part manufacturer that came along. It came out of engineering, went through the processing and routing department. They had to determine what machine it would take, what tooling it would take, for every step of the manufacture and the cost of it, and then present this to management, to upper management, to decide if they wanted to produce it. Well, he flabbergasted me because I was in the tool room while he was still working at processing, and a print would come down and call for somebody to go and get this particular old fixture that was outdated for the job that it had been running. And I happened to get one of those and, you know, get it out of storage. So I called my dad and I said, where would I find that thing? He said, you go down under Heat Creek, and he told me right where to go, and he said what bay number it was, and he said, it'll be back in on the last skid on the bottom row of fixtures, the between rows of fixtures on the skid. I said, how do you know that? He says, I know that's where it is. He said, I had to look it up before I processed it. Went down there, shoot, there it was. And I just couldn't believe it. And other people would come to him and say, Howard, this old fixture we used to use there, will that work on this particular part? He'd look at it and say, sure, I can tell you right where it is. The guy would go down and get it, check it out. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, it was okay to work. And we'd alter it. That was our job mainly. On some of this stuff, if we had an old fixture, we'd have to alter it. Maybe it would be a pump jig type with a handle that clamped the part down while they drilled holes or something in it, and definitely make some new locators or something like that for it. But it was amazing to me what a memory the old timers had, almost as good as computers today.
Yeah.
Because that was their life. And their whole life revolved around Rio. And I've known a lot of the guys that worked up there with my dad and everything. And, they were all pretty well cut out of the same cloth, you know. They weren't highly educated people, but they knew the job.
They felt proud about it.
You bet. Pride was the big thing.
And so... You say his whole life was kind of wrapped around Rio, and that included your whole family?
Well,
with activities?
Yeah. We considered Rio as our second home, you know. Of course, we weren't allowed to make tours through the plant. But, or something like that. You know, like the real clubhouse, that was a must for every Friday afternoon. Us kids would go, because the folks, lots of times they didn't care about going to the movie or something, but it gave a good place for us to go.
And they could feel like you were safe there.
Yeah, right.
It's just like after school, you could go down for a meal.
And
was there a charge?
No, you had to have the real clubhouse ticket.
Right, you were telling us that some kids would sneak in, though.
Yeah, well, Zook Harton, and he was the guy that always watched, you know, because you come in, you had to go through these double doors and everything. He'd stand there and he'd watch, wouldn't say much. Everybody called him, not to his face, but they'd say, oh, horse faces, we're going to have trouble getting in. He had a long, quite a long face, you know, and he was a pleasant guy. If you ever caught him laughing, he was the jolliest guy in the world, but he could put on a mean-looking face and scare kids, you know, and they're trying to sneak in, and he kind of scared them and say, I'm really not supposed to be here. Go ahead.
What was his name?
Harton. I don't know what his first name was, but they called him Zook. Z-O-O-K.
Oh, Zook. That's a great name.
Yeah. And the last name was?
Harton. H-A-R-T-O-N.
Thank you.
Now that's a long ways back. That's back when I were a children.
Mm-hmm. And how many brothers and sisters did you have?
Had four brothers and one sister. Had, well, really two sisters. The reason we moved back into Lansing from out by Potterville in 29 was my sister died. Mm-hmm. She was only 4 years old. But then...
She needed medical?
Well, yeah, and they said she died basically a strep throat, but then there was some other complication, and that was it was way early in the knowledge about strep throat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't have antibiotics or anything.
No, but we had the veterinarian up 3 or 4 times for her, but he couldn't help her.
you touched on something I wanted to ask too. You were talking about the real family and the things that you all did there, and you talked about your sister being ill, and I'm just wondering, were there any kind of medical benefits or health for families of the workers?
No, had no idea of that at all.
That was
something that came in later years after the union got in there, and it was a negotiated item, and the company agreed to pay that kind of stuff as a part of the wage package.
What other kinds of things would the company do for an employer,
I didn't know, but Louis Garcia was telling me that they would help you buy a house. Mm. I think what they did was to guarantee your loan from a bank. Now, I think that's what it was. Yeah, I don't think they took a mortgage on your property. I think they just said, we will guarantee this.
Can you imagine that happening?
I know.
Well, you couldn't do it now because there'd be two.
So many
people. And you have so many diversified people in a plant. And like the reason I didn't go to Ohl's was because I would just be a number. And while it worked at Rio, I don't care if I was just doing tool room work and building fixtures. If I didn't think the design would work, I'd call the designer and he would come down and go over it with me and say, you're right, and go back through process and get the approval of something and then come back down as a change, and we'd go ahead and do it. But if I went over to the Ohl's, I would have been better off to take financially because my pension would have been higher. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to give up that feeling of being a cog in the machine. You know, everybody has a place in the operation of this big machine. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to give that up to become just nobody.
But the people who worked on the things knew something about what they were
doing.
Obviously, you were appreciated for your work.
Well,
you felt appreciated.
That's what we always felt until Capric's gang came in.
Yeah.
Then we were nothing. And
this was in the 60s or 70s?
Oh, no. That was, well,
early 70s?
Early 70s, because I retired in 74. And I would say he got it probably around 70 or 71. It wasn't too long, and I really think that he thought if the place is going to make him a mint of money in the first year or so, he'd keep it running. But if it didn't, he was all set to bankrupt the thing And he was going to draw money anyway. It wasn't going to make any difference. But...
there were a lot of people out of work, weren't there?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yep, and a lot of them with a lot of years just short of qualifying for pension.
Oh, my gosh.
And that, my oldest brother, he stayed there until they quit manufacturing, and he drew a part of his pension. Well, I said part of it. Yeah, he couldn't draw full, but he had enough years working time there that he could draw I guess he got about 70-80% of his pension.
Mm-hmm. You were telling me earlier that the members of your family that worked there, would you tell me again who all worked for Rio?
Well, they were both of my grandfathers.
Oh, your grandfathers too?
Oh, yeah. Probably. That's what I said. We go back a long way. Both of my grandfathers.
To the old plants. Before Rio even?
No, at Rio.
Just at Rio.
They just started in Rio. My mother's father had been a school teacher, and he went to work at Rio. And my dad's father went to work at Rio, and that must have been 1924, because in 24 we moved up to the farm of Potica, so it would have been in the late teens or early 20s.
Mm-hmm. Were they in that, assembly too?
No. My grandfather, Eggleston, on my mother's side, he worked in the engine build-up, which was right along Washington Avenue at that time. That was when they set them on a table or a cart and built the engine piece by piece and shoved it to somebody else.
Before they
set up the moving line over in the motor plant.
So that was like 1904 or something you're thinking of?
Well, no, I'd say probably in any time up until, in 1926 is when they put most of the machines into the motor plant. That's when the motor plant was built. It was around 25, 26, somewhere in there. They were building John Bean, when I was at Christian C. Street School, and we left there in 24.
John Bean was just across the street from
me. Yeah, that was real. It was built as a body paint shop and stuff for real. That's what it was built for. And they had the tramway went over Cedar Street, over into the buildings, over across the Lakeshore tracks. And they came in on the fourth floor over there. And the bodies, they had pickup boxes, cabs, and stuff like that, going through that stuff. Hmm. So, my grandfather Green probably went there in 17, 18, somewhere in there.
After the war.
Yeah, and...
during the war.
Yeah, and then... my grandfather Eggleston, I don't know exactly when he started in there, but probably somewhere along that area, because my mother worked at the old Bruce and High grocery store at the corner of Baker and Cedar, and she saw my dad come and pick up his sister, who was working there with her. And the next day she said, "That's the man I want to marry."
Oh. I remember that grocery store.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was such a romantic, interesting
thing. Oh, well, I tell you. But then she got a job working at Rio.
What did she do?
I don't know exactly what she worked on, but it was, I don't know if it was in the seats or something, but
she was actual production workers or something?
Yeah, she worked there until about the time they got married.
I had women doing the sewing.
Yes.
For the seats and stuff.
They did.
Yeah,
they
all kinds of stuff, but yeah, handwork, then,
right,
and it's a few machines,
handwork.
But, you know.
Was that paint piecework, too?
Well, I presume so. I think everything along that line was.
Mm-hmm. And did she quit when she married?
Yeah, or maybe just before. I'm not just sure about the sequence of that stuff.
I was just wondering if she didn't want married women working there, or she just quit so she could be home.
I think so. But she... yeah, almost told the family secret. She thought it was a big joke, and it was a big joke.
We can always turn the tape off.
See, you won't get sued now, maybe.
But back in those days, you know, women didn't talk about such things as being pregnant and like that. But they were married September 26th, I believe, in 1914, they were married. And they went downtown and got married by justice of the peace named Force. And so she'd go around and talking with friends and stuff, and she'd, well, we were married in September, but Forrest and Charles was born in November. And at that time, everybody was just shocked. You know, she didn't say that. But then she'd explain that it was a year later, and Justice Forrest was...
I know where he gets his.
Yeah, right.
But she did work there, and then my dad's sister that used to work at the grocery store with her, she went there to work for a while. And different ones in the family, all of his brothers, and some of my mother's brothers, she had three brothers, and I think two of them worked at Rio for a while. So we've been associated with Rio as, you know, a family thing. And
did the family members get the other ones, the employment to the shop?
Well, I think so. My dad, in 41, he asked me if I had seen, would you like a job at Rio? And I said, well, not really. I don't want to work inside. But I said, if I can get a job for the summer, that's okay with me. But
that's what you're saying, that Rio was the longest summer job that you ever had.
And so he made the arrangements for me to go to the employment office and fill out the application. And when my name went through, boy, they picked me right off. Come on, you're going in. So I didn't think anything about it until about... 10-12 years later, I went over to the drinking fountain and got a drink of water, and these two guys were standing there talking together, and they saw me stop there, and I just straightened up, and this one guy said, well, he said, I don't suppose it bothers you any that somebody's going to get laid off. He says, your dad got your job in here. I said, hey, remember one thing, anybody can get you a job in here, but you've got to make your own way. And I said, there's no way that I would ever do anything that would jeopardize my dad's reputation. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the biggest load I ever carried, was being careful that I didn't jeopardize my dad's reputation. Because it has made me feel real good in recent years. Larry Coon lives up at St. John's. He worked down there for years. And we were at the reunion out there at Coral Gables. And he was talking with a couple of guys, and I walked up by there, and he said, no, there's the guy that, how was it? He made some remark, you know, about me not working when I was there. He said, he's a lot different than his dad. He said, his dad was the greatest guy you'd ever seen in your life. And I thought, that's pretty darn nice, you know, for him to say that, because he didn't have to. But my dad was well-respected, and I've always been proud of being able to follow him. But, you know.
Now, you said your family had a farm in
Potterville? Out north of Potterville. North of Potterville? Yeah. And my dad, he worked at Rio then.
Yeah.
He would come home from work, jump on the tractor, and go out
after work,
and run till dark, come back up and milk cows, go back out and run till close to midnight, get up 3 o'clock in the morning, go down, he had 26 cows to milk by hand, and milk those cows, go down to Rio, work all day, come back out, run the truck. He was thankful for a rainy afternoon, you know, so he could take a few hours off. But then the worst part was along in 32, this was after we were out to Grand Lakes, which made him about a 12-mile drive, 32, 33, that area in there, 34 maybe. They shut down, they closed down, and worked 4 hours a day.
Because of the depression.
Yeah, you come in and work as long as we have any work, for 4 hours, something like that. Then you go home, and he said, well, why can't we work 3 8-hour days? We're not working unless we got the request, got the orders.
parts.
And so he would drive that 12 miles each way, work 4 hours. I don't know how he ever had anything left on his paycheck, you know?
What kind of a car did you finally drive? Did you have a reel?
Oh, yeah. I was telling you about that one reel. This is when he had reels previously, but he also had a Maxwell and a couple other cars. I can't remember. I seemed like he had a Star, but I'm not sure. I know he had a Model T Ford. And
a competition.
In about 1926 or 27, he bought this reel with a Briscoe body. Mm-hmm. And we thought that was just great. A Briscoe body. Oh, it was something fantastic, you know. And it did have roll up windows in it. It was a wooden frame body.
Roll up windows were rather new then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And his other cars had side curtains, snap on side curtains. Rain or wind, you know, you snap on the side curtains. And so, but then he bought another reel. See, it seemed like it was a 34. Yes, it was. It was a 34, a black one. Had the flare fenders about like that Dietrich body. Had flare fenders about like that. And the doors opened from the front. They were hinged in the back.
Like the suicide
door? Yeah, right. It's really dangerous.
Right. 33 Ford and them came out with it. And they put all these cars out without realizing if somebody starts opening that door when they're going down the road, it's going to jerk them out of the car.
Yeah.
And no seatbelt. But he had that car. I've got a picture of him standing beside it. And the angle I took that picture, it looks like that must be a 16-cylinder straight engine. You know, it looks like that hood is 8 foot long.
They
were big cars. They weren't that big. It was just a distortion effect of the angle.
We had a touring car here that had a 16-cylinder engine in it. I don't know, 7 touring car, I believe it was. And it's being restored in Florida now, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest engine ever built.
Yeah, I think Cadillac came out with a V12, and I don't know if they ever came out with a V16 or not. They had a V12, but that was shorter, you know, because you put just 8 cylinders or 6 cylinders on the side, and it was a shorter engine. Mm-hmm.
You were telling me that there's a picture of your family that was taken at Rio?
Yeah, and it seems to me, but I'm not sure, it seems to me we had like an 8x10. I know that Hilda Smith used to work in personnel, and she called me and told me to come up and pick up any pictures I wanted.
Hmm.
When they were closing the place out, she said, "I've gone through a lot of these and I've sorted out some of you and your family, and I'd like to have you come get them." So I did. Some of them were tool room gang pictures, and some of them were the family. But I know that I'm not sure if it was real spirit or real items. They had two or three different papers that were published.
Over here.
It was color print and everything. It was once a month, usually. Sometimes I think they put them out every 2 months, like during the summer or something. They have a little variation, but Art Sinclair was the artist. How come you know everything?
I've read all this stuff already. Arthur Sinclair also was the one involved with the clubhouse, too.
Right.
Clubhouse.
Yep.
He managed it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And
So
I got that picture that I'm not sure where it is. On the way down, I said, no way. Because my sister called me yesterday from Florida. I told her I was coming down here, and she said, "Are you going
to
take along our picture?" And I said, "I don't know where it is now."
Yeah,
well,
that would be great to see.
I will find it and bring it down, but it's one of those things that if someplace up there, and our house isn't that big, but my wife made a 16x20 crew picture of an Indian chief.
Mm-hmm.
She's put it away No, where she can't find it.
So
that picture may, that picture may be hard to find, I don't know, but I'll find it and bring it down.
Now, during the Depression, did the farm help, having the farm help?
Well,
because, you know, you mentioned a lot of the guys that had farms.
We had some of our food from the farm, like beef or pork, chickens, things like that, which helped out tremendously. And then we always had a big garden spot, raised a bunch of potatoes and things like that.
Yeah. I read some letters from Rio people to the company during the Depression. They had them in the archives. Mm. They wrote from their farms in St. John's and all the outlying areas saying, "We're out here waiting.
Yeah.
Whenever you have the jobs for us, we'll come on back."
Oh, absolutely.
And then, you know, they at least knew that they could survive up there in the farms until they had...
Well, yes, you can get by. But, my God. Oh, yeah. Well, and you'd raise grain and stuff and sell that off. Or they used to raise wheat, and they'd take it over to Portland to the flour mills and trade it for flour. So they'd bring the flour back, and women would use the flour and stuff.
Right. What was it harder to work on the farm or in the factory?
Do you think? It's kind of a toss-up. You see, harder, I don't know. Farm work was difficult because back then we didn't have all the mechanized stuff they've got now. Right. We had a tractor and things like that, but there's an awful lot of handwork involved. Mm-hmm. And then, but you were your own boss. You decide you will do this today or that today, whatever you want. You go to the factory, you punch in that time card, and there's somebody got an eye on you. You feel that you're being watched. And if you don't produce things, they're right on your back.
But a bad storm doesn't ruin, you know, a whole season's worth of work. Either.
Right.
So it's a little more regular.
Oh, yeah, it's regular. Yeah. But like I say, which is harder, I don't really know. Making a living is easier in the plant than it is on a farm. Mm-hmm. When we rode to Potterville in 1926, monsoon rains, I say monsoon, that's from India, monsoon. The equinoxial rains came and deadhead 26 acres of beans, navy beans, all ready to pull. The ground got so wet they couldn't pull them. Mm-hmm. Stood right there and rotted.
Oh.
And so that was a little bit of a tough year.
Yeah, right.
And that was the year beans were high priced.
Oh, that's probably why.
That hurt.
What kind of wages do you think your father was earning at the shop in those days?
I don't know. I know that when I started there in 41, I got 40 cents an hour.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you that. 40 cents an hour.
Yeah.
When you came back after your wartime experiences, what kind of wage did you start out at?
We started out at 60 cents. So then I worked in the tool room in the tooling business there for the rest of the time, but I'd say probably close to 6 months, and George Barnett was our superintendent then, and I knew he knew my dad, and I went up there and I said, "George, I kind of think I deserve more money." And he says, "Well, I think you do too, so I'll put it in for you." So he jumped me up to 80 cents. So I went along for near a year, and Frank Keltz and I, Frank is dead now, and Bruce Lushwe, I believe it was, he was working in there with us. All three of us doing the same job in the tool room. And Frank and I got together and we said, "Hey, let's go talk to him about getting a raise. We ought to be getting $1 an hour. So Bruce wasn't there that day. He was in school. He was a part-time student. And so Frank and I went up there and talked to George. And George said, "Well, the only way I can do that is if two of you guys can do the work. Then I'll have to cut you back, take one man off, and let the two of you do that work. And so I can pay you guys each $1 an hour, and we'll let Bruce go. He's part-time anyway." So next day, Bruce came in, and we told him what George had just said, and he said, "That's fine with me." He said, you guys are going to stay here and I'm not. And the last I heard of him was that he had joined the Lansing Police Force.
Oh.
I don't know, you know, all the ins and outs of that or anything. But that's when you got your raises back then. You had to go to the boss and tell him you wanted.
Yeah. It didn't just come along automatically because of good work.
No.
You had to go fight for a raise.
You had to go and talk to them. And, you know, nobody got mad. We just talked about the situation. And they said, it's fine. Mm-hmm. Well, then from then on, I got my raises pretty regular, but they weren't rapid. They weren't rapid. You could work 6 months or a year before they finally give you some more money.
Did they take things like how many children you had to support and things like that into account?
Not to my knowledge. I say not to my knowledge. At that time, I wasn't involved in that. And so, when I was married, but we didn't have any children right then. Mm-hmm. And so, I think that supervisors in those days had a lot more concern for their workers. And if they were having a rough go on the outside, I think they would say, well, hey, we'll give you a little raise here.
Mm-hmm. To help you along.
All they had to do was justify it to their boss. Mm-hmm. And they were rather humane about the thing, you know, and caring, and so. But things did get out of hand because inequalities, and that's why I spent 1 year on the. Well, mentioned Lester Washburn, and
then
that year, the one they called the labor holiday.
Yeah.
That year, he was up for, I mean, I don't know if it was that same year, but then when he was up for re-election.
After the war? After World War II?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was up for re-election as president of the local.
Right.
And a bunch of guys came to me and my brother and three other guys. They picked the biggest guys they could find. Guys they could trust.
Mm-hmm.
They said, we want you guys over there guarding the ballot box.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go over there and stayed all day and all night.
Mm-hmm.
Up there where the real radio station used to be, above the showroom across from the clubhouse.
Well, across from the clubhouse.
Yeah.
It wasn't in the clubhouse.
No, it was across from the clubhouse. And that's where they held the election.
Mm-hmm. It was a contract election? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it was him, the office, the union official.
The union
officials. It was him. It was him for an election.
Okay.
And they had somebody running against him, and we went up there and watched those ballot boxes. And they told us, watch it because they're going to be ganging up on you and trying to throw you downstairs.
Oh,
so stick together. So we did. Well, we were five pretty good sized guys. And they'd get together and talk, but they didn't start anything. Came up, he was thrown out. The election went our way because,
right.
And they were just so sure that they would stuff the ballot boxes.
And they might have.
And they could have very easily, because you never have 100% vote. And all they got to do is run in some more ballots,
mm-hmm.
voting for him.
Let me ask you this about the union. There were obviously lots of people who belonged to the union, workers that belonged to the union.
I did.
But also who felt very, very good about the company, too.
Oh, absolutely.
So they weren't contradictory, those things.
No. What got me, I was in the union.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then when I went on supervision, I had to resign from the union. They dropped me out.
Right.
And whenever we would have a problem, the guys would say, you're a company man. I said, aren't you? Well, no, I'm a union man first. I said, if the company doesn't make money, how do you get paid? Well, and they'd start thinking. Well, the stewards would come to me and say, hey, you've got to do this. He said, you're the enemy, and I'm for the working people. And I said, look, my job is to ensure the future of the company for the future of the workers.
Mm-hmm.
And if this is detrimental to that, I'm not going to sign it. I said, if you want to take it on up to personnel, and if they want to agree to it, that's okay. It's surprising how many people I got convinced that management is not an adversary. Management is somebody that has to keep the place going. Mm-hmm. And an awful lot of people didn't want that responsibility. Some people thought it was just a cushy job. You just sit around and look smart, whether you are or not. Well,
yeah.
You had to make decisions that maybe it was against your own beliefs, but it was for the good of the company. You had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was on both sides of the fence. I never was a firm believer in an autocratic rule by union because of the fact that somebody's got to protect management's interest to keep the place going.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, when there was nobody protecting management's interest, it went bankrupt. And I think that is just as true today, and I really feel that this is one of the reasons we're having all this problem with Japan importing stuff is because management, and Oldsmobile is guilty of this too, they don't want you rocking the boat with the union. Give them whatever they want, we'll just raise the price. Pretty soon that price is, now, I can't go buy a new car. I'll buy a used car.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to dip into reserves to buy a car when I can get one that'll run and do the job. And I think that this is a factor that somebody's going to have to face. Unions in their original concept were good, really good. They were to ensure that workers were treated equally.
Mm-hmm.
But then it got perverted around to where we'll tell you what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that is bad. And to me, the worst thing about the union was that they brought everybody down to the lowest common denominator. If you had a crew of 20 people, and three or four of them were super, and the rest of them were good, and you had a couple of bad apples, these upper people are going to drop right down to the bad apple because he's drawing just as much money as I am. So I've seen both sides of the picture, and I can see good and bad in both of them. But they've each got to be in control. I mean, they've got to be controlled. Management can't run roughshod over their employees, and the union shouldn't force the company into doing things that's going to jeopardize their future, because the future is what we're all looking at.
Mm-hmm. What kind of changes did you see in the shop from what you did? And I guess I also want to ask you, what kind of changes did you see in the way of people? Did they feel the same? Did they have that family feel right from the street, right on the street through, do you think?
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind, yes. When I first went to work there, first thing they did, does your dad work here? And something, you know, like my foreman, Ed Cavanaugh, down in the city. He said, your dad work here? And I said, yeah. What's his name? Howard Green. Oh, I know him. And I was a member of his family, you know, as far as the working was concerned. And I think it held that way. It might have, no, I can't say really that it eased off in the later years. We went through a lot of employees because we had the military contracts. And they boosted employment up to what, somewhere around 4,500, like that. And so we got a lot of people in that weren't real oriented.
Did they hire a lot of women?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. No problems.
Oh, no problems. I was going to ask you.
No. The one problem that always came up, it seemed, was women had a weight restriction. Not their weight. Not their one. No.
I'm going to get a minute. Wait a minute.
No. But like down in Department 32 in the engine plant where the machine parts, they would put them in stock pans.
Oh.
Well, maybe that stock pan is way bigger than 50 pounds if they're small bolts or something like that, and too heavy for a woman to lift.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon the guy says, well, hey, wait a minute. She's drawing the same money I am. But management worked around it. They got things set up so that one thing, they put in some conveyor so the stockman would put the pan on the conveyor. She could just roll it right down the conveyor to her machine, work out of it. Then the conveyor was movable. They could take it to another machine and set it up and things like that. So together, they worked things out.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as family feel, those people that were there for a temporary type job, you know what I mean, they were there because we had the high production, but when we dropped back down to standard production, we had basically old line people there. And a few, even a few of those people that worked there just maybe a couple of years during the high employment period. If you see one of them outside now, you know, out in the store or something like that, they come right up and talk to you. Right? You used to work at Rio.
Yeah.
And so you get reacquainted, but they still have that feeling. Now, they only worked there 2 years. The rest of their work time was at some other place. But they remember you from Rio. Mm-hmm. So I think that Rio made a deep impression on whoever came here to work. Mm-hmm. If they were satisfactory employees. Some employees weren't satisfactory and they didn't stay more than maybe 3-4 days or a couple of weeks. But anybody that stayed there and worked, I think, made an impression on them because of management's primary attitude. And that was that we make a good product, we need good people. They wouldn't just do anything to satisfy people's demands. I mean, they had to be reasonable demands if they wanted something. But I think that filtered down from the top, that management wanted good people working there.
You're speaking about the top. I'd like to, if you don't mind, digress mm-hmm. for just a minute and go back and ask. We touched on it earlier, and I was asking you if what your father remembered of Dick Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Did he ever make any comments about Ariels himself, about how the men felt about him, or did he come out
no,
talk
I
to
see,
them?
No, see, at that time, when Ariels was there, my dad would have been working down on the assembly line or in the tank track department. Mm-hmm. Or even maybe he was still just driving cars to Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
But after he got to working in the plant, is when he knew all these guys.
There was a guy Chapin that used to drive cars. Did you do that? Or he used to test cars or something.
Roy Chapin.
Yeah. Now I've heard that name.
I have too.
Yeah.
He could have been.
He did that. Horace in New
yes,
York.
Yes, he did. Yes.
I thought of him when you mentioned your dad, because he did something like that too.
Oh, yeah.
He was an old engineer there.
Okay. Yeah, and I see, you hear names like that, a lot of them you don't associate with them except in regards to what they did at Rio or something like that. You know, somebody mentioned names, I heard their name.
Yeah.
But if they could say, well, he worked on this, oh yeah, yeah.
So you would have known
Ariel. I doubt that he would have known him personally, because his workstation at that time, I would think, would have been driving cars to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then when he first went into plant to work, he's a new employee and probably wasn't, you might say, hobnobbing with people at all strata of the plant.
I'm kind of interested too in the radio station, and you were telling me it was across the street.
Oh yeah, WREO.
So it would have been on Washington.
Oh yeah,
on the west side
of mm-hmm. Washington.
Did you ever hear the radio station? Was it something that everybody
could
hear at home on the radio?
Well, you had the old crystal set. The old radio with the crystal set. You didn't have all this dials and stuff then. Then they'd have to go in and turn that little crystal until it picked up the frequency of the radio station.
Like we did our antennas in the 50s when we first got TV antennas.
You had to turn it until you got the best picture.
Oh, okay.
Crystal, and half the time, I say half the time, part of the time, you couldn't hear them very well due to noise and stuff like that.
Static and interference.
And if your crystal was a little bit bad, it didn't fine-tune.
What kind of programming did they have on it? And was it, did it run all day long, or was it just on and a couple hours
at night? I think it was only a part-time radio. I'm sure it didn't go 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they probably ran part of the day and into the evening or something.
Keep your fingers crossed.
You look late, son, so I think
okay. I just hope I'm not erasing what I already did.
Should we stop and find out?
Yes,
what
I need
to do
I'm
that.
I'm just terrified that I did bought this thing yesterday.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
not the most mechanical person that.
Well, you're talking to a fellow here that is.
Not with that stuff. That's modern stuff.
Oh, Lord. I may have been.
I thought the only way to erase it was just to tape over the top of it.
Yeah, you turned the tape over.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah, you did. What?
I
saw you put the tape in there.
I just hope I did it right.
But it didn't run very far this time.
No, I did. You couldn't have.
Well, if you're running.
I saw it heat over, so.
Yeah, but the thing is that if you're just running this, this is a new tape on this side. You wouldn't get anything on it.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah,
right.
Let me just think that.
Which is what it is. So I guess it's okay.
Yeah, just run it back where you were.
Alright, so we'll just rewind.
Yeah.
And record. All right.
Yeah, see, that wasn't very much of it.
No. Alright, here goes.
Good.
And this went on, huh?
Yes, your light's on.
Good.
Yeah. Well, we were just talking about WREO, the radio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, as a kid, I can remember the folks sitting there listening to WREO. And I think they just talked about generalities, you know, maybe a little bit of news, local news and stuff like that, and maybe some of the happenings in the plant or something of that nature. But, and it probably played some records or something like that, you know, for music. But I don't have any vivid recollection. I don't remember any jokes they told.
No, everybody had radios back then.
Oh, no.
Well, that's a good point.
No.
Not very many
people. Like I said, the old crystal set, where you had to turn a crystal to bring it into frequency.
Oh.
You didn't have radio tubes and stuff. I can remember in about 1927, probably 27 or 28, my dad's brother, he lived out there by Potterville too, and he was working at Rio at the time. And he bought an Atwater Kent radio. It's a real old one. And it had speakers standing up there like this, you know, and he had to adjust about three dials to get this in. And it was going to be a price fight. And I almost believe it was Jack Dempsey, but I don't know. And they were all sitting there listening in that radio, you know, and some of us kids made a little bit of noise. All colors. So we went out, and the radio was sitting right by a window. And we got right under the window and sat down on the ground and listening to that thing. But we weren't really interested in the fight, but they were listening to it, so we wanted to hear it.
Yeah. What kind of things did you see when you were you taken to the clubhouse for, like I was saying at the luncheon that Major Bowles came?
Yeah.
Did you go to see different?
Oh yeah, we went to see different things if they thought that we were interested or if we thought we were interested. They were called Lyceum numbers.
Lyceum, that's what you mentioned.
Oh,
yeah. And they would bring these people, acts and stuff like that in there. And this was prior to the movies. The colored movie.
Oh.
Yeah. And they would bring these people in and they would put on their show, musical shows, anything like that that they could book. And that was always on Thursday night, but I think it was only once a month. And when the real spirit came out, one of the first things they wanted to do was look down through and see what's on. You know,
that's right.
What the schedule is.
Yeah. They had good movies there, too, because I used to watch to see what they had showing.
I remember
they had first run movies there. Yeah.
Did they?
Yep. And they were the first ones to have color cameras. Put on color movies. I went there. And the first colored movie I saw was Trail of the Lonesome Pine.
Is that right?
And that was back. That was about.
Well, they must have had silence too. They went from.
Oh, they used to have silence. Oh, yes.
Yeah, like Chaplin.
Yeah.
What about some of the clubs and things? Did your parents go out, like your dad, and then did you, like the bowling, the baseball?
My dad never.
He was farming.
Never got into. Yeah, he never seemed to have time to get into any clubs or anything like that.
Because the Rio baseball team was supposed to be very good.
That's what I wondered. Didn't they have a football team too?
I mentioned Larry Coons talking about my dad. Larry Coons came down to the Rio. Jerry, somebody was the personnel manager, and he was a great athletics booster, and he hired Larry on the spot because Larry was a good baseball player, and his main job.
You thinking about Cy Rapp?
No, I knew Cy Rapp because he's the one my dad talked to about getting me in there.
Okay.
What the heck was
I'm trying to think too, but I can't remember.
He was there quite a while. But anyway, he hired Larry, and his main job was to be able to play baseball. I mean, he had to put in an appearance, but he wasn't going to be working on sheet metal or
right.
something. He might cut his
hands. Hands.
You know, he had
maybe he did an inspection job or
well,
something.
Well, he ended up in the materials division. Supervisor there, but
because if you read the spirit, that's such a big part of it is all the different teams.
You bet.
Right, bowling and baseball.
Right. Well, that's somebody mentioned a rifle range.
Right.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Where
yeah.
was
yeah.
that?
It was up. I think it was on the third. I think fourth floor, maybe. Right in back of the main office building.
Now you know what they mentioned also? Quats. Quotes.
Horseshoe pitch.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Horseshoe pitch.
Oh.
Yep. They had tournaments.
They said
and
that
stuff.
Was very popular.
Yeah.
Too.
That was
well,
up
sure,
there someplace near the
I don't
field.
Know exactly.
They said they did it in the field.
There was
see, they had some other properties too. They had a lawnmower testing plot out south, I believe, around Logan and Washington somewhere.
Up
and
where the old fairgrounds used to be.
Yeah.
That way.
Yeah. Hmm. And. So it might have been some of it out there. About the only thing that I got into was our steering gear club. It was all management.
Oh, that's right. That's it. Louis mentioned that.
Yeah, any level of management went there. In fact, you were expected to go.
Mm-hmm. And what was that, just a social group?
Yeah. Well, and also the boss man, like Claire Laubenslager, he was always... he would get up there and give us a standing in the company, how we stand and what we had to do and any new program that was coming out, he'd let us in on it and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a confidential type thing, but before they announced it to the press or anything, he would tell us.
Mm-hmm.
And if the company was having trouble with finances, we weren't getting enough in, he'd jump onto us about getting more production out for the man hour and stuff like that. Then we'd go into the program and they always put on a big fee.
Oh.
And guy that had Ye Old Country Caterers out in DeWitt, he worked in engineering in the chemical lab. Metals testing and stuff like that with Hengoski, Clarence Hengoski. He was in charge of it. And Leon, he needs stuffed pork chops. And
good.
You talk about a meal. And we get all through, everybody had been served, and some of them maybe even went back for a second. They'd go up and grab the mic and say, hey, still a lot of food left back there. Go back and eat all you want.
You all meet at the pork house?
Yep. Always, well, it's about the only place I've been.
Yeah, right.
There must have been a lot of rooms in that building.
Well, the main ballroom is where we had everything.
I see.
We had everything. No, smaller groups, like if Claire wanted to talk to his production people, he would have them in a back room. You went in the doors and around to the right, and they had a room back in there. If it was just a foreman's meeting, like when the guy that was head of Diamond Team, when he came in there, Eddie's name before I started to talk. When he came in, they brought him in, they brought all the supervisors in, and we were in that back room back there, and Zenon Hansen, that's the guy. And he came in there and talked to us, and everybody thought, well, you know, this is going to be great, because he was going to be president of the company.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his ideas didn't last very long. He had some ideas, but he couldn't cope with our style of production because we had moving assembly lines, and at Diamond T, they pushed them by hand.
In the 60s still they pushed them by
hand?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. They would take the frame and set it on the axles that had the wheels on. They bolt them on. Then they start building up from there. When these guys got done with theirs, they pushed it to the next station.
Well, I'm sure it pushed the body.
Electricity bills, right?
Well,
they did push the body, too.
Yeah, and so...
Yes, I do
so,
remember that now.
He just couldn't quite adapt to our process and things that he wanted to do didn't go down well with White. And so... he just left there and went and took over Mack Truck.
Oh.
So he still had a good job. But then, we just went along as a part of White. Now, this Claire Lobstocker, he was a production manager. And he was good. I mean, he was the kind of a guy that you wanted for a friend because he could be a terrible enemy. Anybody that, you know, that didn't want to produce. Now, he didn't take things too personally. I mean, you could tell him what you thought, and he didn't get mad at you. But he knew who wasn't producing. He didn't care what their level was. He'd tell them, either you produce or you're out the door.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't produce, they didn't change their ways, they were out the door. He could be quite ruthless, but he was loyal. I'll tell you, anybody that he knew did the job for real, he'd go to bat for them, and he didn't care if he had to go through the top of White Motors. They got a fair shake, which was very good. I had him mad at me one time, the year I was committee man. It was a contract year, and we wanted to change from piecework to hourly rate. And so they got up a slate of candidates. I was one of them. My brother was one of them. I don't know why we always ran in pairs, but everything that happened, we were...
numbers.
Yeah, and I think this dates back to my dad.
Oh, really?
You know, respect for my dad. They said, well, hey, those two guys are honest. We know
mm-hmm.
we can trust them.
I think they're great.
But I was... instrumental in negotiating the contract, and we convinced Herb Everhardness and the rest of them, Claire, that the company would be better off with an hourly rate and a production standard than have piecework where one guy could make $4.50 an hour, another guy couldn't make $1.50. We said, that isn't fair. So they agreed to it, and we put it in. Well, then, probably 6 months or so later, we had a job up in the cab lining, the solderers. Now, the cab was put together in three pieces. They had the back and the top came together with the front cowl, and then you had your side panels, but they would put them together, clamp them into place in the fixture, and spot weld them. This seam went right across, about this far above the windshield, went right across the top of the cab. It was spot welded together. But then, if the dies weren't quite right, there'd be a gap, maybe it'd be 3/4 inch wide, and about this far back in. And they had to melt lead and fill those in, and then polish them off.
Yeah.
And so, this one guy up there, he was doing the leading part-time. Now, they didn't need... I think they had two guys doing it full-time. They didn't need three guys full-time. So they used a guy that was working at a station right near there. And he could lead them in and everything, do the job. So they had him work, and he'd work maybe 3 or 4 hours a day. Well, the guys doing the legging got a nickel an hour more than his job called for. And so I went to Claire and talked to him. He was a union manager, or union leader, you know, the representative. And so talked to Claire and I told him about the situation. I said, I really think the guy deserves that extra nickel. And he said, okay, I'll check with the foreman up there and see what the deal is. And if that's right, he'll get his nickel. Next day, he called me and said, the guy got his raise. I said, great. So probably a couple of weeks later, I was walking from the motor plant over to the shipping area, and Claire met me right in the middle of the railroad tracks. And boy, did he jump on the knee. Yeah. He said, what are you trying to pull on me anyway? I don't know what you're talking about. He said, you're talking me into giving that guy a nickel raise. He said, no, 16 guys down the line want the same raise. I said, Claire, as far as I'm concerned, they don't deserve it. So I said, don't give in them. They don't do that work. This guy was doing a special job for the company, and I think that he deserved as much money. And then, so they're using him on a lesser job. He's always available, fill in for vacation or anything like that. He looked at me and he said, boy, I'm glad you said that. Mm. He said, that's exactly what I want to hear you say. So everything was, that's what I said. He could jump onto you, but you proved your point. Mm-hmm. Everything was fine. Mm-hmm. He was without doubt the one guy that could keep real going, but they fired him.
They keep what?
Oh, well, they trumped up a lot of, well, I don't know if they trumped up a lot of charges, but I mean, they threw in a lot of things. I don't know exactly who fired him. Whoever was up at the top, yeah. But they said that he was, that he had a little company set up to overhaul what they call dummy trucks, the power lift trucks. And that he was sending real trucks out there to be rebuilt and bringing them back in, and then the company paid his company.
Uh-huh.
Nothing really wrong with it, as long as he was doing a good job and doing it cheaper. But then they said somebody saw him stealing stuff, or not stealing. He'd tell some guy, put this on a truck and take it up to my place in Open Lake, on the lake. Some materials and stuff. Maybe it's scrap material, but they didn't care. They just said, he's stealing the company blind, off you go. It wasn't too long, I don't know, maybe a couple of years or so, he came back. And I remember I was in the office upstairs. This was after I went up to superintendent tour. And I was up there, and Claire came in there, and he looked at me and he said, well, I hope I didn't hurt your feelings when I fired your good buddy over. Arvid Berg had come in as a specialist in efficiency and everything. Mm-hmm. And he was head of all this area, and I was working for him. I said, no, Claire, I think you did what you had to do. I said, you're going to have to fire other people. If you have to fire me, go ahead and do it. Mm-hmm. And looked at me and said, well, I thought you were on his side. I said, no. The only side I'm on is company side, and I don't care who I'm working for or with. Boy, did he smell it right down. I was one of his boys. And I think that is an attitude that everybody looked for when they wanted to make somebody into a supervisor. Mm-hmm. Of course, my boss told me, he said, you're never going to get a promotion until you get somebody trained to take your job. Mm-hmm. Good thinking, so I did it.
You said earlier that everybody in the plant was cut from the same cloth, but...
Well, I'm talking about the old-timers, the guys that worked with my dad.
Right.
The guys that worked with my dad.
Right.
And here again, you don't know if they're cut from the same cloth or if they're molded to the same pattern.
Yeah, that's a good... It's a
they can go either way.
Yeah.
Working made them better people. Mm-hmm. Working with these others made them better people. Or if they just happen to get the type of people that... you know, they had those values.
Right. And that's what you mean, like, really mean. You mean values and attitudes.
Yeah, right,
and
And they came from similar backgrounds, too. They were probably raised in the same kind of mindset at that time,
they pretty much did. Mm-hmm. Then in later years, we had all kinds of experts come in that had done this for this shop or that for that shop, and boy, everybody thought they were going to cut a wide swath, and they couldn't cope with the complexity of our problems because we built what the customer wanted. Mm-hmm. Oldsmobile goes down the line and they put out parts by the thousand. This part goes on that car, and that's it. Real, if a guy wanted some little special valve, and we had a case of this out at Cedar Rapids, Iowa, this little valve was made, and this guy wanted it. We didn't normally stock it. Engineering had to find a way to incorporate that valve in this truck for him, for his. That was in when they were building this truck.
Wow. When they would order a car, they would specify if they
in the
truck.
This is strictly trucks.
The truck.
Right. Yeah,
and
strictly
then it would be
for particular use.
Right.
It would be built in their specification.
We had a couple, I guess we made six of them. We took the real V8 engine and modified it so that four cylinders could be used as a compressor or as a compression addition to the engine. This guy was hauling dry concrete, powder, and he'd haul it to the silos, and then they had to have a blower that would shoot it up into the silo from the top, see, because they always had film from the top. And so he came to engineering and asked them if they could give him something. So they came up with this modification for a V8 engine, and they made him one. And we had to machine the cylinder blocks even in the tool room. They had to set them up and machine them by hand because they were experimental and nobody else had the equipment that would do it. And we made special parts for it that they needed. They weren't ready for production. There wasn't enough call for it, and so we made him up this one, and he took that thing, I believe it was in Ohio, where he took that thing and tried it out. And he said it worked like a dream. He had a switch that would cut the ignition off to these four cylinders.
I looked at the other one.
And so the other four were running, and they pushed these up and down, and as it came up on compression, it pushed air out, and through the pipe, and that was his compressor for blowing that powder up into the silo.
Right.
And we made him six of those. Mm-hmm. But then there wasn't any great demand for it. This guy liked them, but maybe there weren't too many truckers in that situation, because a lot of them in later years have gone to bottom dumpers on those things. They go over a pit and they bottom dump in there and they have a blower that shoots it up.
Yeah.
But this guy, he wanted that, so we spent money. He paid for it, I presume.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But,
I'm sure he did.
But we made it for him.
Willing to do that.
But yes. No matter what they wanted, engineering, and that's where Spartan Motors originated from out there at Charlotte, is real people, real engineers and stuff like that, that have started that up. And now they are going great guns. They're building motorhome chassis and fire trucks, anything that somebody wants.
Special equipment,
big power brooms for sweeping airport runways, a lot of things like that.
Huh.
So Spartan Motors is an offshoot of Real Motors.
Well, isn't that interesting? I just talked to somebody the day when I went to the new firehouse opening, grand opening, just across from Waverly High School.
Oh, yeah.
And it's either the new pumper truck or the new air, what they call their air truck, was built there. I think it was
the
air truck. Mm-hmm. And when you said that, I wanted to ask you, what about safety? For say when your dad was working there, what kind of provisions were for the employees who say they get hurt on the job?
There was one thing, a real organization, and I belonged to that at the time I worked there too. I think that went out. They called it the Real Benefit Association.
Mutual Benefit.
Real Benefit. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Where everybody
like $50 a year or something.
Well, I think that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the word. I think I paid 12 cents a payday.
12
something
cents
like
payday.
That. Yep. That was taken out for Real Benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you were off work 7 days, you could draw, and it was only $2 or $3 a day that you could draw, because it was based on values back in the way early years.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, for somebody that's getting $12-$15 an hour, $2 a day wouldn't mean a thing. I mean, you buy a couple cans of Coke or something like that.
Well, for $2, you got everybody a sack of groceries then.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the thing of it. That did. So you could draw, I think it was $2 a day. And so that would make you $14 a week. Well, that kind of kept the wolf away from the door a little bit at that time. Yeah. Because in those days, they didn't have all the prepared foods they have now. You just bought basic staples and they prepared it. So a little money went further in that respect. Today it wouldn't, because $14, my gosh, you can't walk in out the door for that. But that was the one thing. But as far as until the state and federal compensation laws, workers' compensation came in, until that time, I think that it wasn't an accepted policy, but I think that they did do things for people who were hurt in the factory. Like, they would put them on as elevator operators.
Something
that they could do. Right. We had a guy who was clerk in the tool room, and he took care of the court orders called in and stuff like that for the care of work or anything. And then he kept the records of how much work was done on this project and that project. And he had polio when he was a kid. He only had this, his right leg was doubled up like this, so he couldn't get that anywhere near the ground. And this one, he had a brace on it that came up here and fastened around just above his knee, and it had a pivot there, went down and hooked into the side of his shoe. And he had a strap across to hold it in. One day, his